but any suggestion that staffing decisions are influenced by union affiliation or advocacy is unfounded. They added that, quote, "We look forward to our next regularly scheduled collective bargaining session with NSLU and express their desire to, quote, find a resolution that reflects our values and supports our dedicated staff." For KBU News, I'm John Giacobbe in Northeast Portland.
KBU News poet Dan Raphael has President Trump all figured out in a nick of time.
With Trump's gazillion orders, firings, and proclamations, it's easy to be overwhelmed, confused. What the bleep is going on here? The answer's simple. Everything Trump is doing is aimed at bringing down the federal government. Cut communications, dismiss experienced employees, eliminate entire agencies, piss off our allies and those we've been giving aid to. The government falls and all that's left standing is Donnie, President Vance, Emperor Musk, not born in U.S. so can't be prez, but maybe the Supreme Court will change that. Maybe they'll nullify the amendment that says no more than two terms. Stand up, listen, and speak your mind. Encourage good folks still in power, like our senators, to rail and sue against Donnie's blitzkrieg of illegalities. Unemployment will be going up. Prices and inflation will be going up. Federal funding slashed. How long can Donnie blame it all on Biden and Obama? We, the people, need to share, to act, to defend those we can, to defy those we must. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBU Evening News for Wednesday, February 5th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Anna Wilcox, Dan Raphael, John Giacobbe, and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodewell. Special thanks to Alex Gonzalez, Isabel Charlet, Eric Galatas, and Antonio Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Luda Winchester.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. Historic LA wildfires are still smoldering. The Oregon legislature is back in session. A massively controversial plan to drastically amend the Northwest Forest Plan governing management policies on over 20 million acres of our most precious forests barrels forward, and that little matter of he who shall not be named returning to power and confirming that, yes, we are in the darkest and dumbest timeline. So with so much to cover, why am I putting out a rerun today? Well, I was all set to put out a brand new episode featuring speakers from a recent University of Oregon symposium on the hugely consequential topic of tribal sovereignty and tribal inclusion in the Northwest Forest Plan. But we had some last-minute scheduling issues, and I didn't have time to arrange a backup interview. However, the event explored some incredibly important, thorny, and inspiring issues, and I hope to bring you a conversation with some of those tribal voices next episode. While I work to put together a new set of interviews on the good, the bad. We'll be right back. From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. Historic LA wildfires are still smoldering. The Oregon legislature is back in session. A massively controversial plan to drastically amend the Northwest Forest Plan governing management policies on over 20 million acres of our most precious forests barrels forward, and that little matter of he who shall not be named returning to power and confirming that, yes, we are in the darkest and dumbest timeline. So with so much to cover, why am I putting out a rerun today? Well, I was all set to put out a brand new episode featuring speakers from a recent University of Oregon symposium on the hugely consequential topic of tribal sovereignty and tribal inclusion in the Northwest Forest Plan. But we had some last-minute scheduling issues, and I didn't have time to arrange a backup interview. However, the event explored some incredibly important, thorny, and inspiring issues, and I hope to bring you a conversation with some of those tribal voices next episode. While I work to put together a new set of interviews on the good, the bad, and the ugly of the Northwest Forest Plan draft amendment, including how you can help protect our most treasured forests, I think this is actually a great time to revisit an episode from last year on wildfire myths, facts, and misinformation. Even if you already listened to this conversation when it came out, it's really worth a second listen. I spend a lot of my time immersed in wildfire research, and I still got so much out of listening back to this interview. I think you will too, so let's get to that interview from last year with Ralph Bloomers. And I will note real quick that we did discuss some proposed legislation from last year, but I think it's still mostly relevant as we are dealing with a lot of the same issues coming into the 2025 legislative session. And of course, stay tuned for updates on that. From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. So I don't have to tell anyone listening to this that here in the West, wildfires are a fact of life. I'm also sure that most folks listening are already aware that the climate crisis, combined with more and more homes being built in and around forest lands, is creating an escalating cycle of devastation in fire-prone communities. There is a tremendous amount of pressure on politicians and agencies to act, or at least to be seen to be acting. But right now, too many people, including key decision makers, are looking at the problem entirely backwards. So to talk about the real solutions to protecting communities from wildfires, as well as an exciting piece of legislation making its way through Salem, I am joined by Ralph Bloomers. Ralph is the director of Fire Safe Communities for the Green Oregon Alliance, producer of an award-winning documentary called Elemental, and has worked on forest conservation issues for decades. He has a wealth of information on wildfires, the right and wrong way to protect communities and homes, and the current legislative efforts to address these issues. Before we get started, you can listen to all of our episodes for free on any podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc., or at coastrange.org. And we also are so thankful for our community radio partners. You can email me anytime with feedback, questions, show ideas, whatever. I'm at michael@coastrange.org. Okay, without further ado, Ralph Bloomers, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me. Hello, everyone. Good to be here.
Well, let's dive right in. You know, we're going to be talking a lot about this specific legislative proposal by Senator Jeff Golden, which would fund wildfire protection and resilience efforts, in part by bringing back a severance tax on large industrial timber companies. And there's a lot to discuss with that, and I want to get into that. But I think we should start the conversation with a foundation of the problem we're trying to solve here. So could you start us off with sort of a quick primer or maybe catch up on the issue of wildfires and the interaction of fire and communities?
There's three key components: fighting wildfire, also known as suppression. And that happens both by structural firefighters and wildland firefighters. Suppression can be incredibly expensive. The Dixie Fire, which was a fire that burned in California in 2020, they spent $100 million+ on that. And it burned for 100 days. They had 6,000 people on it. They had a massive amount of air tankers. And that thing just burned until the weather came along. And that's really the case with a lot of these suppression efforts, is we have been confused in our understanding and our capabilities because for a long time we had a nice, cool, wet climate period. Second is, what do we do with our landscapes, which are varied? We have dry forest types, we have wet forest types, we have shrublands, we have grasslands. All of them can burn, and all of them can generate embers that can enter into and burn structures and communities. And all of them have a legacy of things that we've done, whether we've pulled out wood products, whether we've suppressed fire and kept fire out of them, we've built roads in them, we've grazed them and logged them. And then the third is, what do we do to protect homes and communities? Well, most of us buy insurance to protect our homes in case we have a loss. But what if we want to do something to prevent the loss, right? We might do something to retrofit our house for an earthquake. We might do some things if there's a flood. And there's things we can do for wildfire to interrupt the potential for our house to catch fire. That's called home hardening. And another way of thinking about it is climate resilience or climate mitigation.
Absolutely. And when I say that many key decision makers are thinking about the problem backwards, I'm referring to the idea that we need to fight these things from the forest in instead of the home out and community out. So could you talk to me a little bit more about some of this dissonance in how the problem is being framed versus what the research says about how we actually protect homes and communities from fire? Because obviously we can't get to the right solution if we're asking the wrong questions.
Yes. I really appreciate that very thoughtful question on how do we collectively reach a common shared language and understanding about what we can do, right? Because there are very clear solutions for preventing home and community destruction. And there are communities in the West that are doing the things collectively to get their communities to be ready for the most extreme conditions. And so I think that one way to think of it is, as you've talked about it, is how do we, with limited dollars, we can't continually print money, get our communities ready for what we're seeing, which is increased fire activity across the landscape and these other things that we're seeing, right? These events. And then the fact that 8, 9 out of 10 fires on the landscape are caused by people. Huge amounts of fires are caused by people in and around 4th of July. Significant numbers of fires that burned communities down in California and now in Oregon were caused by power lines during wind events. But where we are confounded is this belief that we can affect fire behavior and control fire either through suppression or managing vegetation on the landscape. And there's a number of reasons why that's super challenging. No particular order, but mathematics. Let's just start with the math. If you've ever done some clearing around your home, built a pile and burned it, you know how much work it just is to do that, right? And then it grows back and you got to do it again. And every year you got to clean your gutter, right? It's manpower, it's labor, it costs money, it costs time. So the average cost to, let's say, thinning a patch of forest is between $2,000, $4,000 an acre, and sometimes even upward. So we've got 30 million acres of forest. Let's just say that thinning works for the sake of argument. Multiply that times $2,000 an acre. No, we'll never have that kind of money. Billions, tens of billions of dollars to do it one time.
Mm-hmm.
You take that on a nationwide scale and you're never going to get there. And the Department of Interior Inspector General, they've all looked at it. They said it would take 60 to 90 years to thin a portion of a portion of a portion of the landscape that's deemed high risk one time. And what happens in the meanwhile? It grows back. So it's all about prioritizing. In Oregon, unlike in Australia or even in Canada, fire has been used as a reason to enter into landscapes to cut wood products, cut timber. And so the narrative really pushed during the Bush years in the early 20s, the 2000s and the aughts was, you know, we need healthy forests and we get to healthy forests by cutting them. And then there's also some timber companies, for example, that don't own a lot of private lands. They rely on federal timber. So they promote that narrative of we need to enter into forest to get wood out. And we're doing a win-win and we're getting fire risk reduction. And the forest is choked with fuels. Okay, so there's some nuance and complexity in there that I don't see the need to unpack, but you can imagine that, you know, there's also other narratives. Most of the fires are on federal lands, and you hear sometimes the federal lands are like slums. And, you know, the reality is the statistics show that most of the ignitions are on private lands. They're in and around communities where people are, and most of the fire starts are in those private lands, not in public land. So, you know, there are narratives that have emerged for commodity interests, and then those are promoted by certain people in positions of influence, elected officials. And there are also, though, I think this thing that just sort of our collective understanding has been confused by a cool, wet period in our climate, right? That gave us this belief that we could control fire through suppression or vegetation management over time and space, because from the 40s to the late 80s, we had a cool, wet climate period making suppression possible. So it kind of confused our understanding. And in a lot of ways, our understandings are the result of the land utilization and the various things that we've done over multiple decades that created these expectations. And unlike hurricanes or floods, there is an ability that we have to some degree to influence fire behavior. So, you know, I like to be thinking about the listener here with respect and say that, you know, we've all been confused. I've been confused by it. And I've tried to go on this journey of discovery to understand it better. And what's been wonderful is we can separate these things out and have a much better definition of the problem for what we want to achieve. And I'll just say one other thing is, like, most folks on the Coast Range, you know what's in, you're in and around. You're in and around timber plantations, tree farms. The Oregon State University research done on them is they burn hotter. Well, why? Because they're even aged. The crowns are close together. They're dense. They're not old trees. They grow them to 35, 45, 55, 60, whatever years old, and they cut them down again. So they're at an elevated fire risk. So I think the point, the take home, Michael, is forest management can affect fire behavior positively, negatively, or not at all in extreme conditions. And we can just agree that we'll never have enough money to manipulate vegetation over space and time. So we just need to focus our efforts. And if we want to get timber to use for paper and wood products, we should just say, let's get timber and use it for paper and wood products. But fire is not a good excuse.
Right, right. We need to be clear about what we're doing and why. And I mean, I think of all the points that you're making, to me, the most salient, whatever my like personal political beliefs are around it, just the math around it, the fact that it really is impossible for us to do this on a landscape scale. So regardless of how you feel about it personally, like what you wish we were doing, like we need to talk about what we can actually do. And that really is a great segue. I think a lot of times in our society, we're putting the onus on the individual to do what they need to do to protect themselves. There's a lot of that sort of individualism that is kind of pushed onto us. But this really is a community problem, because even if your home is perfectly fire resistant, perfectly home hardened, if all of the other homes around you are going up in flames, like yours might too. And so this is something that we all have to work together on. And it is important that not only the people that can afford to do these things, that have the time to do it or the money to do it, get those resources and are able to protect their homes. So I think that is one of the things that Senator Jeff Golden is trying to address in this legislation that I know that you've been working on a little bit and are very familiar with. So let's transition to that now. I want to dig down into some of the specifics of the bill, but I wonder if you could just give us the kind of 30-second elevator pitch real quick on the bill, and then we can drill down into the specifics and key highlights.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the inspiration for a lot of the work that smart people are trying to do around this is some communities that are really getting this right. So there are some communities in California and Colorado, they're assessing every house, the firefighters are doing it, and they're doing it, you know, once every 3 years, once every 5 years. And there's programs, chipper days, support, assessments that are made available electronically, and you're getting 65, 70% of the people doing the things. It's awesome. I had no idea how possible it was until I was out and about with the film and I met all these folks and really excited about it. And I think there's a lot more hope in leadership. I was at a meeting in Salem this morning with Chief of Fire Protection, the State Fire Marshal, the Chief of Wildland and Fire, and a whole bunch of really, really committed people. There seemed to be a lot of agreement. But the big deal for this legislation is, where's the money going to come from? Is it going to come from the general fund, from all of us, from our general tax dollars? Does it come from a levy on our property? Who can pay their fair share? And I think there's been a lot of discussion and news coverage in the Oregonian and OPB and ProPublica about the elimination of what was called the severance tax, which is a tax on timber value harvested from industrial forest lands in the 90s. And that really starved rural counties in Oregon of money for essential services, for fire, for police, for all the things that county governments pay for. So a number of folks believe that a significant portion of the money for wildfire and for water protection should come from these large corporate landowners. And I think that's been well covered in a series of articles that you probably discussed in previous episodes, but you can find them. They center in on Falls City in Oregon, and they do some calculations about how much was lost, but it's over $3 billion in revenues. And so there's some sense of everyone needs to pay their fair share. And what does that look like? That's sort of where the money comes from. But what I'm most interested in is where the money goes. And, you know, we can agree that there's a number of strategies and things that we might want to do. The challenging thing is making the hard calls about what investments to make and what things that are the most durable and effective over space and time. And so I think that's what Senator Golden is trying to do, is really commit money to those areas that haven't had the same investment, and specifically to fire-safe homes and communities. That's the pieces that I'm most excited about. Just to say a little bit more about the timber tax on value, I mean, you have a lot of real estate investment trusts in the state of Oregon that own significant portions of our 6.8 million acres of forest lands that are industrially harvested. That money is basically made off those lands tax-free. And there's a cost for Oregon. The cost is fire suppression costs on those private forest lands, a cost in terms of reduced water supplies, quantity and quality, as well documented by a number of studies. And you see this manifest in, you know, Rockaway Beach or in Newport, where, and even in other, you know, Timbertown, USA, Willamina is having 48-hour water calls in the summer months with low flows. So there's a cost from industrial harvest, elevated fire risk, increased fire risk to communities from that and fire intensity, okay? And then also decreased water supplies. There's other efforts being made to address some of those things, but there's also just a huge export of wealth to Wall Street and, you know, a certain significant percentage of the forest products industry is not contributing to the challenges we face here in Oregon. That's a decision for the legislature to make, where the money comes from. As far as I'm concerned, I can offer some perspective on it. Where the money goes is far more interesting, right? We know we have a wildfire challenge. There's a suppression component. We need to pay for suppression because there's going to be stupid human-caused fires that we got to deal with. Whether it's a gender reveal party or somebody playing with a firework, yeah, some of those we're going to want to put out. And particularly when they're in and around communities, that costs something. There is a component to properly managing lands. That's got to be paid for. But what Jeff Golden has started with Senate Bill 762 that was passed in the 21 legislature is a significant investment in our fire services, the Office of State Fire Marshal, fire departments that are hugely trusted, know their communities, to do assessments of homes and be like, hey, instead of just telling people you got to do 100 feet out, which some people don't have 100 feet from their neighbor, and it's overwhelming, saying here's the priorities, here's what it looks like, here's some support, and really investing in those mitigation programs, you know, those hazard mitigation programs. Also identifying areas that are at higher risk for priority work. And so it's, you know, what we saw was the 2020 Labor Day fires precipitated a bunch of fire legislation, which was a start, and then a significant allocation of money, and then those have atrophied. And that's what Senator Golden is recognizing. The money that was allocated for those things has shrunk. $35 million for community resilience went down to $3 million. And he's like, no, we need permanent funding for wildfire programs in the state of Oregon, or the insurance companies will exit, or communities will burn to the ground. And then the other piece that he recognized is we need to spend more money on drinking water protection when drinking watersheds are impacted by various disturbances, which include harvest or fire. And so a portion of his money goes to that, of the money in the legislation. There's a number of conversations happening right now in the legislature, other proposals. Some are saying $10 on everybody that owns property. Well, you probably, if you pay property tax, you already see you have a levy for fire. And so I think a lot of the fire folks in the fire services are concerned that the state is going to add to everybody when they're already paying. And also, is that fair? There's other things, but you're right, Michael, this is most likely to get to a permanent source of funding for wildfire. It's got to be referred to the voters and let the people decide. Mm-hmm. And so that's another component, an unfortunate component of the dynamic in Salem and people talking past each other.
Absolutely. And I don't think, unfortunately, we have time to really touch on the competing proposals out there. But I know that reflexively, I'll just say that you might say, oh, $10 for every landowner, let's all chip in and pay our share. Well, if I pay $10 and Weyerhaeuser pays $10 and they have many, many more ignition sources, is that really fair? And is that getting us where we need to be, even in terms of dollar amount?
Yeah, they have 6,500 parcels, so they'd pay $65,000. But, you know, they're still making billions a year. And they have a huge land area, millions of acres, or over a million in Oregon, right? So between 1 and 2 million, I think it is. So they pose a much bigger risk and burden, both on the water system, given that 80% of our water comes from forested watersheds. And then, like, you know, just we're already paying for fire protection. If you own forest land, we're already paying through local levies and local property tax. You know, so they got to figure it out in Salem. What is the right proper source of funding? The point being, I think, is that large corporate real estate investment trusts are set up specifically to avoid all taxation in the state of Oregon. And they're paying a little bit on a harvest tax. It's not at all made up for what was eliminated in the 90s. Mm-hmm. It's a bad deal for Oregon. And I think that there's a conversation that is happening around what is a fair deal for Oregonians. And then presenting that is a possible outcome of this legislative short session to the voters to decide.
Absolutely. And for anybody interested in learning more, I'm going to link to not only the OPB ProPublica series, Polluted by Money, that you referenced earlier, but also a couple recent really great articles from the Oregon Capital Chronicle talking about Senator Golden's bill, the competing bill, some of the conflicts of interest in the competing bill, et cetera. So as we start to wrap up, if folks want to learn more about Senator Golden's work on wildfire resilience, especially this legislation, and maybe want to get involved in helping, where do they go? How can they get involved in this effort?
He does a pretty good newsletter that keeps people posted and breaks it down, and it's just direct. I mean, I really, really appreciate his leadership. And, you know, it depends on how deep you want to go, but I think that you could sign up for his newsletter. He probably is going to post some things from time to time. But there's been good coverage in the Oregon Capital Chronicle. There's going to be, I expect, coverage in OPB. That's a very trusted news source. You can, you know, Google news for Senator Golden on wildfire and read more about what he's done in the past and what he wants to do in the future. around it. He's led a lot of those kinds of conversations. If you really want to nerd out, you can, you know, you can go to Oregon Legislative Information Service and track it down and watch hearings and watch what he's said in the past. I mean, there's particular things, but that would be going super deep. But I think he's, the work that he's done has gotten a lot of good news coverage, particularly in Jefferson Public Radio, where he's from in Ashland. And Ashland is really one of the leaders. Chief Chambers and others down there are doing and starting to scale up home and community assessments in that community. You know, they had the Alameda fire that burned down Talon and Phoenix. So they've lived and breathed the kinds of loss that, you know, Lincoln City and Otis had on the coast. They had the most loss of any community. So anyway, yeah, just look for news articles and sign up for his newsletter and you can follow some of the things that he's been doing and trying to do.
Great. And folks can also email me and I'll do my best to keep folks in the loop. And we at the Coast Range Association will definitely be tracking this bill and we will work with partners to put out timely information. There's so much more that we could get to today because there's a lot more to be said around the wildfire discussion, timber severance tax, etc. So maybe we'll be able to revisit this in a future episode. But for now, is there anything specific that we've missed or you want to make sure gets included?
I've spent a lot of time doing wildlife and time-lapse photography, and I know from traveling with Elemental Reimagine Wildfire and interacting with folks that, you know, they really appreciate seeing that. So I, you know, encourage folks to check out greenoregon.org, where we've shared a lot of the wildlife and time-lapse photography we've done in burned landscapes. It people really feel good seeing that stuff and that hope. And we have